I am from beyond. Listen, and all you desire will be yours. Welcome to Spider-Dan and the Secret Wars. Prepare for battle.
Welcome to Prattle World. I'm your host, the ever-amazing, the ever-spectacular Spider-Dan, and in this podcast, I spotlight entertainment's best-kept secrets that a mainstream audience may find boring. Welcome back, guys. This is me again. You're back with the Renegade Master, Dan, once again. I've debuted my first podcast last week, and I would like to thank everybody that's downloaded, everybody that's listened on all the various platforms. It took me a while to get it on everything. I was hoping that when I started on Podbean that they misled me a little bit. They said that it would be available in several different platforms kind of once it had been uploaded. That wasn't the case. I had to do it manually. So I've put it on. We're now available on Spotify. We're available. It's just me again. Nobody else here. Minus the elf with a gun at the window who's forcing me to do the podcast. We're available on Spotify, iTunes, Stitch, and Podbean. I'm looking into other platforms if they are free, or at least a little cheaper, and possibly going to put something on YouTube in the future. But I just want to thank everybody that's downloaded, everybody that's took the time to listen to it, all the constructive criticism I've had, and all the compliments as well. I do take that on board. So thank you very much for all your support and just basically listening to me waffle on and on, which is probably the thing I do best. My biggest strength and my biggest weakness. So let's start off with the show, as I like to start off all the shows, with the Secret Boar Journal.
Dear Secret Boar Journal.
Okay, so this week I've been a bit busier in regards to geek culture than I was the previous week, but as I said, I was busy doing a play, rehearsing and being in a play. What have I been doing? So speaking of plays, I had to go and record some songs, basically, and dialogue from a play I did back in... June? I think it was July. And it was called Westernized. So it's kind of imagine Blazing Saddles, but a play version of that with a lot of kind of wacky spoof antics, songs and various other things. I played the bartender, which I also served drinks at the bar to give it that kind of immersive experience. So that was before the show and during the interval. I also played the villain of the piece, an Irish... an Irish kind of racist bar owner. Obviously, it's very much a satire of the times. Very much, it's not offensive in that way. But we know we're poking fun at the way the West was. It's a lot of fun. And if you like Red Dead Redemption, it's probably right up your alley. I don't know if we're doing it again, possibly. But there is going to be an album. That's the company's called Death by Pie. I recommend following them online because I'm basically a part of it as well. And we do those kind of spoof. We've done a haunted house spoof. We've done a noir detective spoof about the NHS. So we do lots of kind of fun shows. And they're not necessarily shows for the theatre goer. We try to open it up. Nathan Smith is our leader, director, writer, producer. The rest of us are just basically in it and do what we can and add our own spin on things. But it's very much a collaborative process. It was a really good show. So I went down to his flat and to record songs and dialogue and stuff, and it was really fun. And he posted me recording some dialogue and some bits of the song out of context, so it looks really weird. And one of the lines is just breakfast, just me shouting breakfast to nothing. But obviously, I've got the headphones on, and I can hear all the songs and all the bits of pieces that's going along with that. But yeah, and after that, I decided that we were going to watch my friend Daniel Keatis, or at DL Keatis on Twitter, lent me the Blu-ray of The Death of Superman, so which is a new DC animated movie. They have done it before. They've done an adaptation which was called Superman Doomsday, which I really liked. But this one is a little more in line with the comics, a little closer to the comics. And there's going to be a sequel that's going to include all the Superman replacements. Reign of the Superman, it's called. So that one I'm actually looking forward to, because Superman Doomsday didn't really include those characters. And I do quite like those characters as well. But they don't hold a candle to the original, obviously. But yeah, so that was my week. Went to see, what else was in my week? No, there is more. I got double glazing finally. I live in a kind of small one bedroom flat, and last winter I almost froze to death. I'll be honest, it was so cold. I had to get electric blankets and heaters and hot water bottles and all sorts, just anything I could do to kind of keep the warmth in the house. And my bills were sky high. It was a nightmare. But my landlord was like, yeah, we'll get it done in August. I'm like, fair enough, in August. August came. Are you going to do that double glazing? Yeah. Oh, good. September, you double glazing? Any chance? Yeah, definitely. And then the last month, I've just been texting him every week just to make sure it's happening before he got, to January, December time, February, when it'd be, freezing my bollocks off. But he has done it, thank God. And it is it's a bit warmer, not loads, but it's better than it was. But yeah, so yeah. And also, what else have I been up to? Oh yeah, yep. Yeah. I've set up in relation to the alternativity stories, hashtag alternativity stories that I'm doing up until the new year. I'm doing a charity. I'm basically raising money for children in need. It's on justgiving.com. If you type in Santa Hat Challenge, I should come up. I'll also post the link. I think I already have on Twitter and Facebook, so give that a look. Basically, I'm trying to raise £1,000 for children in need, because about 10 years ago, I did a full body wax for charity. Never again, and I wouldn't recommend doing it. Ruined my skin for ages. And I was very... I'll tell you what, I was cold when I had... I do have a surplus amount of body hair, not to get too graphic. So I decided to do all that. I was in a lot of pain, but yeah, I felt like, like a shaved, I don't know, animal or something, because I was just freezing. No matter where I was, I was just so used to having covered in this kind of coat of hair. I just froze anywhere I went. I didn't want to do that again. So I've decided to, if we can raise over £1,000 before Boxing Day, that's the deadline, I will wear a Santa hat for a year. Now, when it comes to Christmas, as I've said in the previous podcast, I don't really like it mentioned or said or brought up prior to December. I'm a bit of a Grinch. No, I'm not that Grinchy, but I'm a little Grinchy that way. I hate the people online that are just counting down to Christmas. I'm like, come on, get a life. Wait for the other holidays to be done. Wait for Bonfire Night. Wait for Halloween to be over. At least give us them. And, I just think they, to keep it in that month. That's the Christmas month. That's it, So I will happily... wear that hat for a full 12 months. I tell you what, if we can raise 500, I'll do it for 6 months. I'd do the bare minimum. I'm only just about 10% in, not even 10% towards the goal. So anybody that can donate, please do. I just want to get that kind of ticking away. I'm going to keep sharing it and what have you throughout the next couple of months, the closer we get to Children in Need and the closer we get to Boxing Day. Just think of the children this year that won't have that great a Christmas, that are in care or in poverty and various other terrible situations. Just think about them, and think about how much fun you'll see me having. I'll be putting a diary together of how many people tell me Christmas jokes, songs, all the things that will irritate me throughout the year. So if you want to see me in abject misery, please, please donate. It's a worthy cause, and I would really appreciate anything you can give. I do appreciate it. I've started the ball rolling with myself. I've donated £50 to the cause. I will donate more if we're, you know, if we're close to the goal. I'll definitely donate as much as we need to get there. But please, please do. And if you can't donate, at least share it or retweet it. Do what you can, because I really, really want to raise a lot more than I did last time I did the body wax. I managed to raise about £300. So I really want to kind of push the envelope this time and help as many children in need as possible. Yes. So, before I go, I also want to mention I've been watching the final two Halloween movies for the And the Podcast Starts. So I watched Rob Zombie's Halloween 2 last night, and a couple of nights before I watched the 2018 version. I'm going to do our final podcast for that, which I'm a little sad about, but I'm sure we'll be back for that as well, and be doing some more of those, possibly maybe on a different kind of different horror based kind of Hammer horror films or whatever Dan or Howard decide. Luke's there as well. Luke Richards is going to give his two cents as well, and we'll just see how that turns out. But that will be available on YouTube. I will share that already. Halloween 1 and 2 are up there, the podcasts on those, so you can see what I have to say about those as well as everybody else. But yeah, just give that a try. But that has been my week. All right, so let's move on to the next segment. Okay, this segment is actually from last week. I didn't actually get the... I tried to fit in too much, basically. I tried to fit in too much to the podcast, and I ran over a little bit. So I had to cut a segment or two, which is fine. I'd rather have more content for you than less content. But I really thought it was worth putting this back in, because I did say I would do it. So I'm going to put this back into the podcast. So if it does sound a bit different from last week, you know why. So here is a force to be reckoned with. A force to be reckoned with is basically me spotlighting inspirational women, be it fictional or real life, factual women, and the difference they've made to, you know, I guess feminism and the world at large, and how we see women, how we view women in the big, basically the big picture. So I've selected a fictional woman to begin with. I'm going with Storm, Aurora Munro, leader and member of the X-Men. One of my favorite female characters of all time, a woman of intelligence, strength, beauty, grace, you name it. She is one of the key factors in the X-Men, and, you know, a character that's just grown from strength to strength since her introduction in the 70s. She was created by Len Wein and Dave Cockrum, who are both sadly no longer with us. And she debuted in the giant size X-Men number one in the May of 1975, which introduced a lot of other characters as well, like Nightcrawler, Colossus, Banshee, Banshee and Sunfire were pre-existing. So Colossus, Nightcrawler, and Storm were kind of the new blood, if you will, in the X-Men. And they basically, the X-Men before were five white teenagers, basically. So this basically opened up the whole kind of superhero spectrum in regards to diversity, especially Storm being a black female, an African female superhero, was, you know, not heard of basically at that time in comics. So it was a huge, huge change. Basically, these characters came in and saved the X-Men from a living island. Maybe not the best storyline, but it introduced these characters in the best, most exciting way possible. And she's great. I think she's not had her due in movies. She's not had the spotlight she deserves. It's mostly just her pointing and firing lightning at
toad villains, mostly, and asking silly questions. But yeah, she's an amazing character that just doesn't get the credit. She's got this amazing backstory as well. She was born to an American and an African, but she lived in Cairo very early on in her life. Unfortunately, the house she was living in with her parents got bombed, and she was alive under that wreckage for days and possibly weeks, I think, lying there with the corpses of her dead parents, unfortunately. And this basically gave her claustrophobia. That's probably one of her famous character traits. She's, you know, this earth goddess who, you know, wants to be, you know, out free. You know, she later on in her story, she goes to, I think it's the Serengeti or somewhere in Africa, Kenya, I believe, actually, more likely Kenya, I think. And she develops her powers. She even meets the Black Panther, who's basically on a walkabout as part of his training to become the Black Panther in the future. And they have a kind of little adventure themselves. I can't remember. There's a comic book about it. I can't remember. I think the initial time they first meet is Marvel Team Up, an issue of Marvel Team Up. Back in the 70s or early 80s, I think. But yeah, she basically starts showing her superpowers, her mutant gifts, and basically she's worshipped in Kenya as a god. And, you know, if she can bring, you know, the rains down in Africa, you know, why wouldn't you worship her as a god? She's got these blue eyes as well, these kind of stark, almost cat blue eyes, which is unusual as well as part of her being a mutant, I believe, which is one of her. She's as cool as she is. She's also, you know, she's very beautiful, and a lot of kind of supervillains have fallen in love with her as time has gone on, and I can't really blame them. You know, I'm kind of in love with her myself. Like Doctor Doom, Dracula, she's managed to seduce them in some form. She doesn't get with them, but yeah, she's a credit as well, like to her team and to her powers. And she even you know, when she came out of the wreckage as well as a small child, she was found by the Shadow King, or Mal Farouk, who's the villain in Legion, if you've seen the Legion TV show. And he basically has a group of kind of child pickpockets, and she learns how to kind of pick locks and steal and escape. And that comes in very handy as an X-Man later on in life, when she's kind of in these kind of trapped situations and, you know, cramped spaces, which obviously affects her claustrophobia as well. So yeah, it's really, she's a really interesting character. But the Shadow King, yeah, was kind of her main villain, I guess, for a long time. It was her kind of main. There's an amazing issue of X-Men where you see the kind of young Charles Xavier actually save Storm. He doesn't know she's a mutant yet. He doesn't know her for years later properly, but he basically kills the Shadow King in battle. And that experience there convinces him that he needs to create the X-Men. It's not a battle with Magneto, that kind of comes later, but he knows that mutants exist and there's bad ones out there and they need to be stopped, and we need to live in harmony with humanity as best we possibly can. Going back to Storm, off going on a tangent, I do tend to do that sometimes, so I do apologize. She's an Omega level mutant, which in the comics means if she wanted to, at her peak kind of potential, she could end all life on the planet. She's up there with Iceman, Magneto, and various other lesser known kind of mutants. This is also I think the Phoenix Force, which is the cosmic entity that embodies Jean Grey and gives her all those kind of cosmic abilities in the comics. Not so much in the films. She's kind of a little powered down. You know, she doesn't go around eating planets for fun. In her most powerful form in the movies, she doesn't do that, which is going to make the new Dark Phoenix film very very disappointing because she's not going to do that. And there's not going to be aliens. It's not going to do that because they wanted it grounded. It had to be grounded, didn't it? Ugh, now I hate it. And just hate that idea. She, again, going off topic again. So just one tangent into another tangent. Well done, Dan. So that's how my brain works. Just whoop. Anyway, back to Storm. So she's a bit of a badass. Now in the comics, she started off kind of this very, she loves plants, she loves nature, she loves all this, all life. She doesn't take life. Like, she will absolutely not take a life. She argues with Wolverine till they're blue in the face about, you know, she's one of the people in the X-Men that can talk Wolverine down. Like, there's a great scene in Days of Futures Past, the comic book, where Wolverine goes to stab one of the villains that are attacking Senator Kelly. Kind of similar to the first X-Men film as well. He's about to stab the Blob or someone like that, or Pyro, or Avalanche, one of those kind of Brotherhood villains. And Storm says, "Don't do that." And Wolverine almost stabs her, and she's like, "Go for it." And he goes, "Well, maybe not." Yeah, so it's quite good to see that she's well respected. I think quite recently, before he was killed off in the comics, not for very long, they were actually in a relationship. They had a romantic relationship for a little while until he died, unfortunately. But like I was saying, she started off as this, you know, nature loving. You know, she loves everybody. She's very caring. She's a mothering figure as well, and to many of the younger mutants like Kitty Pryde and Jubilee in the animated series. But yeah, she had a bit of a turn in the mid 80s. She started kind of getting a bit darker and a bit more kind of, for lack of a better word, a kind of more Wolverine, I guess. She started, you know, kind of just going down this dark path. And eventually this led to her, she ended up in a knife fight to the death with Callisto, the leader of the Morlocks. So these are mutants that live underground because they are so hideous. They feel they can't live a normal life on the surface world. So basically, Angel is kidnapped, and the X-Men have to investigate, and they find out Callisto's going to, I think she's going to mate with him or something, I think, or, you know, because he was so beautiful, and, you know, he's a beautiful-looking man. He looks like an angel, you know. So I kind of don't blame her, but maybe not the best way to get a date. She does that, and the X-Men are tied up. There's no way out. They're trapped, and Storm's suffering from her claustrophobia, being in these underground tunnels and these sewer systems. So she steps up and says, "I challenge you for leadership of the Morlocks, and let's have a knife fight, basically." And all the X-Men are like, "What? Where does this come from?" And Storm is actually quite a capable hand-to-hand combatant as well, as it goes, because she manages to win and stabs Callisto directly in the heart, effectively killing her. She luckily has a Morlock mutant healer on hand, so he can fix her broken heart, I guess. But yeah, Storm upped and stabbed her in the heart, basically, and throughout the rest of this kind of storyline builds until there's an adventure in Japan with Wolverine's teammate called Yukio. She was kind of a lover and enemy, kind of villain, hero, badass. You know, she's one of those gray characters, kind of a gray area on that. And she's basically has a death wish. She lives life to the fullest. She could die at any moment. You know, she lives, loves, you know, fights as best she can. And Storm kind of goes along with it and unleashes. She's always been afraid to unleash her power. Like, she gets too angry, you know, storm clouds form, things like that. She's always been quite, she holds herself back a lot. So when it comes to this, she starts like literally just throwing lightning bolts at criminals and stuff. Like, she stops caring. And this actually leads to her having a very drastic change in personality and a drastic change in look. She shaves her head, she has a mohawk, she has this punk aesthetic, very kind of 80s kind of thing. And weirdly enough, it works. And I think that just shows how strong a character that Storm is, how well written she's been through all of her years in comics.
you know, it just works. I don't know. I can't really explain it. Apparently, it was a bit of a joke initially. They're like, oh yeah, we'll just do Storm as a, like, within the kind of Marvel Comics office to make her a punk, but it stuck and it worked. It appeared in the comics and it stuck around a long time. She later lost her powers in a really good story called Life Death, which was written by, I think it's written and drawn by Barry Windsor Smith, who is a phenomenal artist. You should read Weapon X if you ever get a chance. It's an amazing book. I think we reviewed it on Nerdify, which was a podcast I did with Dan Kietis and Josh Fison, which I do miss doing. That's kind of why I'm doing my own one, and I'll definitely have them on a guest at some point. But yeah, she I've lost my train of thought now. So I was basically saying that Storm has a Life Death. That was it. Life Death is basically Forged appears, who's this kind of, his mutant power is he can basically make anything, which is pretty decent mutant power as they go. He's a Vietnam vet. He's a Native American shaman, mystic as well. So it's quite an interesting character, and they fall in love. But also she realizes that he created the weapon that basically stole her powers, and seemingly permanently as well. So she falls in love with Forge and then has her heart broken learning that. And I think there's a Life Death 2 as well, which not as good, but still definitely worth having a look and reading up on that. So yeah, like I was saying, she's a hand-to-hand, amazing hand-to-hand combatant, so much so that when Cyclops had a baby with Madeline Pryor, who later would turn out to be a clone of Jean Grey. I know, comics are weird. she challenged him because she went, he can't be thinking about this child and be, you know, in the death-defying action and adventures that they have. If he's distracted and worrying about the child, that he would be a liability to the team. So Storm steps up and goes, I challenge you to leadership. So, and again, she likes to duel people, seems to be her thing. Just let's have a duel, especially for leaderships as well. Cyclops says, I'll only use my optic. Storm says, I won't use my powers at all because she's a badass. And Cyclops says, I'll use low-level optic blasts. And basically, Storm gets the better of him, takes off his optic visor and says, you dare not open your eyes because you might be pointing at all the people you love and care about. So maybe don't open your eyes and admit defeat. And he does. And he's absolutely brokenhearted about it. He's absolutely gutted. And Cyclops is a character that gets a bad rap, I think. He's a really good character. And I just, again, he's another one in the films that's not been treated with that much respect, in my opinion. I'm just going to talk about one more final thing about Storm. Back in the 90s, there was a Marvel versus DC comic. I know, it was great, it was amazing. Basically, two worlds collide and various characters would fight various characters, and the winners were actually voted by the fans. The fans basically voted who they thought should win. And then they wrote the comic, basically. And they had things like Shazam versus Thor, Hulk versus Superman, Batman versus Captain America, Spider-Man versus Superboy. Yeah, maybe not so much. There was Storm took on Wonder Woman. And at the time, Wonder Woman actually picked up Thor's hammer. So she had all of her powers plus Thor's powers. And Storm turns up and Wonder Woman realizes that it wouldn't be a fair match if she had, you know, these amount of powers. And then Storm soundly defeats Wonder Woman. So maybe it was a bad idea for her to drop Thor's hammer. The fans felt that Storm, with her power set, with her very versatile power set, was better than Wonder Woman. It was a bit of an upset, I think. For myself, I probably would have thought Wonder Woman would take the win. But yeah, that's how the fans voted, and I can see why. Because again, like I said, amazing character, amazingly written. A great kind of ambassador for diversity in comics. Always has been, always will be. Her comics, her solo series are often very good as well. I'd recommend looking at the work of kind of Chris Claremont.
I think X-Men Worlds Apart is pretty cool as well. That's basically when the Shadow King takes over Wakanda and Storm is basically out in the cold, so to speak, and she has to fight her husband, the Black Panther, and various other kind of Wakandans trying to, you know, the Dora Milaje and various other characters like that. She has to deal with them alone. I think she fights Cyclops again. I think some of the X-Men are taking control of as well. Really good comic that. So I'd highly recommend that one as well. Great character and a great woman, and certainly a force to be reckoned with. Okay, guys, so that was A Force to be Reckoned With. I hope you liked all my musings on Storm, my favourite X-Man, one of my favourite X-Men, definitely. So we're going to move on to the feature presentation, as the music indicates, which is part of the Alternativity season, or the hashtag Alternativity Stories. So this is me looking at Christmas movies that, again, people are celebrating early, so I said I'm going to celebrate it early, but in my own way. So I'm looking at films that are either set around Christmas, kind of wintertime, New Year, or that have a Christmassy theme, or a different seasonal holiday, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, any of those kind of included as well, you know, happy holidays and all that. So the first one we're going to look at is actually a Finnish film, so made in Finland, and it was inspired by a couple of short films that were very popular, and it's called Rare Exports, A Christmas Tale. Now, I'll go into spoilers a little bit later, but first of all, the film is basically about a group of hunters in Finland, so in the kind of harsh, kind of mountain area, cold winter wonderland that they live in, and I think from what I understand they basically hunt reindeer. You might have views on that, but that's what they do to survive, and they're living in quite a harsh environment, and they've got wolves at the door, literally wolves at the door, often, and so they have to set traps and various other things, and it basically concerns a couple of kids who unbeknownst to themselves, kind of discover a shady organization. There's always a shady organization in these movies. And they're basically digging in this mountainside, into this mountain, and trying to unearth something that they may not have discovered. And basically, it's deep within this mountain, the Finnish people have trapped Santa, believe it or not. So this Santa is not the regular Coca-Cola version of Santa. It is a kind of demonic Krampus-like creature, so kind of a dark Santa. And these young lads discover that they're digging into the mountain to get Santa. There's this great character played by Per Christian Elofsson. I think the character's called Riley, but he's the opening gambit, the introduction is all in English, so and the rest is pretty much in Finnish for the rest of the film, apart from a few segments. He has this great monologue, and he's telling all the because he's on the mountain, he's worried that Santa is going to basically kind of kill them all, so they've got to be extra careful. So he's got this list of rules. So it's like, you must always appear nice, don't swear, you know, be very good. We have a grave to rob. He has this great voice and this great kind of monologue. And as a child, he was obsessed with finding the real Santa. And he thinks he has in this kind of Finnish mountain, this winter wonderscape. And he hopes this is true. And the boys hear this monologue and they run away. I can't remember the other boy's name, but the main boy, the main character is called Pietari is played by Oni Tomila.
And he's a lovely little actor. He's brilliant. He's got so many sections of this film where he is just superb. And he's his character is this wonderful innocence, this kind of childhood innocence to him. Yet his father called Rauno, played by Jorma Tomila. So I guess they're related. Maybe they are father and son. That's pretty cool. I didn't realize that. So brilliant. And he plays a very, the mother's died. There's a lot of dead mothers in films, isn't there? It's really sad. There's just so many of them. You know, I'd like to see it turned on its head a little bit now and again, but it just seemed to be quite the, it's just dead parents, I think. A lot of films, just a lot of dead parents. So basically they have a very difficult relationship. He's a very hard man, not very sensitive, doesn't communicate his feelings very well. And you know, Pitari, the young boy, is this, you know, bright-eyed, you know, innocent, lovely kid, but he knows he has to kind of grow up and deal with what he has to deal with in this harsh environment. He has to kill animals. He has to survive in this world that he lives in. He has to be a harder man and tougher and less sensitive in a way, and, you know, less good. He has such a great arc in this movie, and he knows what's going on. He's aware of everything, and everyone else is kind of like, what is going on? But in the start of the movie, you see him reading books, you see him reading everything. I'm very wary I'm going to go into spoilers with it. I'll be a bit more careful, in regards to that, the story on the whole is kind of it's a bit of a slow burn, but it's not that doesn't make it a bad thing at all. There's a lot of kind of creepy elements and darker elements. I'd describe it as kind of a Burton-esque meets kind of a Nightmare Before Christmas feel to it a little bit. That kind of dark wonderment that Burton does very well. A little bit of The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing in there as well. And then an element of kind of the Goonies and the kind of Stranger Things. I've always really enjoyed where children are the protagonists in a kind of more adult, darker film. Things like The Lost Boys or things like that. I highly recommend, if you haven't seen it, is the Shane Black written Monster Squad, which is a really cool kind of love letter to the Universal Monsters, and they kind of all team up, and it's kind of this weird kind of adult yet kid film. There's even a line about the werewolf having gonads, so I'd watch it just for that alone. Actually, the way they kill the werewolf's pretty damn awesome as well. Definitely look that up, and it's a Shane Black script, so you can't really go wrong with that. Definitely look that up. Maybe next Halloween you can look that up, or earlier, depending on your choice of movie. But yeah, it's a really atmospheric film. It really draws you in. Again, like Halloween, it's the original Halloween by John Carpenter, it is a slow burn. So it's quote unquote a bit, it's not boring, but it draws you in. It's slow in its pace, it's methodical, and the building of the dread and the suspense is there. But then it's also got a very light, fun feel to it. So it's not too, it's not too harsh, but however it is very ominous. And there's a fair bit of male nudity in this as well. So it's as much as there are children in it, and children are the main characters, it's still relatively adult. So, you don't see anything in too much a good light, but there is a lot of naked older men running around. But I won't spoil any more of that. The music's great, really, really subtle yet effective in kind of using the mood to, further the story as well. It doesn't overpower. It's not the huge, building score or anything, but it's just right. And it's just enough for this particular film, I think. And it conveys the harshness. There's a lot of, there's winds howling a lot of the time, underneath the score as well, and things like that. And it does bring what it needs to bring to this movie. I'm going to go into spoilers now. I think I've avoided the spoilers. So, spoiler warning. All right. So, yeah, the story, basically, Batari thinks he's been naughty by cutting this hole in the fence to see what these men are up to. I think it's on the border between Russia and Finland or something. They do talk about Russia for a bit, but I may have got a bit confused. My geography's not great, so that could be wrong as well. But yeah, he kind of cuts this hole open, and that's how this kind of Santa escapes. And slowly but surely, all the children go missing, and are replaced with these kind of creepy wooden dolls, which is, you know, quite scary. So we don't know what's happened to them. We're not aware of that. But Batari knows. And there's a trap that Rauno leaves for wolves. So he has like a little pig's head. So if you're a bit squeamish when it comes to the killing of animals, probably avoid this movie. It's not a wolf they trap. They trap what they believe to be Santa, this kind of naked, bearded older man. But from what they discover after is that that's not Santa. That's in fact one of his elves. Even though they look exactly like Santa would, it's actually one of his helpers. And the guy who's playing the Santa is so, so watchable. So it draws you in so much. Scarily so. Even the slightest movement or, you know, gesture he makes, you're glued to the screen because you don't know what he's going to do. You don't know what's going to happen there. One of the characters, the elders, kind of gets his ear bitten off, so you have no idea how he's going to move or react. But there is this supernatural feel to him, you know, almost. I know I'm talking about Halloween quite a bit, but it is akin to Michael Myers. The way he moves is unusual and non-human, something other, which is, it really works for this film. I really, really, really enjoyed it. The finale's great. It's a lot of great action set pieces towards the end. So the last 14 minutes to half an hour, all that build-up, all that slow burn is totally worth the wait. It's a lot of fun. It's helicopters involved, guns, you know, you name it. But yeah, it's really worth the watch. And yes, it's just a fun alternate Christmas movie, but it still has that spirit of Christmas. Like the lead character Batari is great as well. Like everyone's great in this film. There's no bad performances. But it can be quite. I think with a lot of time with subtitled movies, you do have to kind of focus a bit more. You do have to concentrate a bit more and make sure you don't get too lost. Like, you know, you've got to put your phone down for once in a while and just actually watch the film. But it does really draw you in. It's really fascinating. It's well filmed. And yeah, it's an absolute delight to watch, and I really highly recommend it to watch something. If you want to watch something unusual, something a bit different, which is what this my alternativity stories are all about. This is the film for you, and yeah, it's great. I couldn't recommend it more. You know, 4 Spideys out of 5, definitely. Really, really fun, unusual. If you're after your, like, a darker Christmas tale, but still have the spirit of Christmas there, this is exactly what you want. So yeah, that's my review of Rare Exports, A Christmas Tale. Couldn't recommend it enough. Couldn't recommend it. It's well filmed. You know, you name it, everything's done well in this movie. And it's not long either. I think it's just under an hour and a half. And it's well worth a watch. Well, definitely. I wouldn't say it's a kids' movie with the nudity and stuff. But if your kids are a little bit more mature, they could probably watch it. But again, like, nothing's really on show particularly, but they are naked, these older elves. I really like the concept of the elves as well. They were really something a bit different. You know, obviously there's a lot of elves that have got, you know, got like a Buddy the Elf, or, you know, the standard elves with the pointy ears and, you know, pointy shoes and tiny height that they have. But yeah, if you're into creepy Santas and
darker takes on Santa and Saint Nick or Father Christmas, however you know him, definitely give this a watch. Great fun, great everything, just good. It was a heck of a Christmas treat for me. So thank you guys for choosing that on Twitter and on Facebook. Thank you for recommending that. I'll have to leave Sint or Saint for next year for when this comes back. But yeah, let's move on to the next segment.
Backstage Past.
Okay, so this is a segment I like to call Backstage Past. So basically, I like to look behind the scenes of movies that had kind of a troubled production. So they've gone through reshoots, possibly, or there's actors don't get along with the director, the producers have issues, money issues, you name it. Any kind of big problems backstage or behind the scenes on a film set, I like to explore. So I always find it quite interesting because the creative process is always it's always interesting to me and how things get made, why things get made the way they are, and why they're cut, edited, and why they're put into the cinema in that form. Or, you know, for example, you know, Justice League with the digital mustache, as silly and as bizarre as that was, it's actually, you know, the stories behind those kind of things are really, really fascinating. Speaking of Superman, this week I'd like to look at the Superman curse. Now, there's a lot of films that have curses behind them, or so-called curses, if you believe in that sort of thing. So films like, mostly horror films like The Omen or The Exorcist, Poltergeist. I think with that, it kind of comes from, you know, we're talking about otherworldly things like Satan or da-da-da-da. You know, all those kind of stuff, and they believe that, you know, they've been cursed. Or it might be things like, I don't know if some more religious films have been cursed by people of that faith because they're not showing religious figures in a healthy light for, you know, in their opinion, or they're making fun of them. So I'm not sure. I'd have to research that a bit more and have a look into that. But this one is about the Superman curse. Now, the Superman curse is there's a little bit of it that's kind of unlucky. So it's very unlucky for some of the people, but there's a lot of people in there that have been involved. It's not just necessarily one film or one TV show or anything. It's basically the Superman mythos and the character themselves. Any kind of time they've been used on film or TV, or even radio in some respects. Sorry, I'm going to have a drink. My throat's gone very dry all of a sudden. Got my lovely tea here, fruit tea. Yes, there we go. I'll whip the whistle, so to speak. So, the Superman curse. Maybe I'm being affected by the Superman curse. My throat! It must be the Superman curse! I'm going to look more specifically at the 1978, the original Superman movie with Christopher Reeve, Marlon Brando, Terrence Stamp, Margot Kidder, you know, the whole kit and caboodle, that classic film, one of my personal favourite comic book movies of all time. And I think that's kind of the go-to Bible of comic book movies. I think that's where you go. You go, right, what worked about this? Why is this such a well-done film? Why is this a perfect adaptation of that classic character? I think Sam Raimi went back to that film for Spider-Man and, you know, and it shows, and I'm glad he did, because that is one of the better Spider-Man films that are out there, if not one of the best. So the Superman curse basically applies to actors, directors, people who work on the movies or starred in them, various people. So we're looking at, I'm going to focus on the Superman movie from 1978. However, the story started before then. So people like George Reeves famously played Superman in the 50s, a very popular version of the character, and he shot himself, which was depicted in the film Hollywoodland. With Ben Affleck playing George Reeves, one of the only actors who technically play Superman and Batman, I guess. So he struggled for work. I think he was a heavy drinker anyway, George Reeves, and he would go on to shoot himself out of depression, I can only assume. I don't really know much about his story particularly.
But yeah, it goes back to then, and you could argue, you know, that the creators struggled for quite a while money wise, and I will get into that. But there's a lot of other people involved in those kind of early productions of Superman. You know, they've struggled for work. I think there's something to be said about playing iconic characters it's so iconic, the character, and you do it so well. You know, for example, you play a Doctor Who, the Doctor, or something like that, and you can find trouble after that being cast as something else. So you may not find as much success or as much work for an actor. So there are issues, and you could argue that is part of the Superman curse, possibly. You know, people like Michael Rosenbaum or Tom Welling or Brandon Routh, you know, all these kind of actors kind of dipped out or disappeared for a while, not in the spotlight. They're still working, obviously. As an actor, I can definitely tell you that, you know, there's long periods where you are not working, and now that's for the good or for the bad, but there's long periods, and it's not necessarily like a lot of people, I think in the Hollywood kind of world, when people disappear, they're like, did they die? What's happened to them? Where did they go? You know, I've seen a lot of videos on YouTube recently. Like, there was one about what happened to Carl Weathers. And I went, Carl Weathers has been working for years. He's not gone anywhere. You know, he's always there. But that's all that video was. It was just like, where's he gone? Like, there's going to be some sordid story. But I was like, they just went, oh, he did this, he did that, he did this. And I'm like, well, yeah, I know he did those things. It was just a silly video. It got me annoyed, wasted my time. Clickbait. Bloody clickbait is what it was. So, yeah, so the Superman curse. Now, going back to the creators of Superman, so that's Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, they created a character in the story, Reign of the Superman. So this was kind of like the idea of the Ubermensch at the time, and kind of that kind of character that was more than human. But this one was actually bald, not unlike Lex Luthor later on, and he was very much an evil character. So he was very much a villainous person, I think, from another planet. I would have to kind of look that up, I think. So from that, they were like, that didn't really work. So they reworked the character into kind of a hero for the kind of common people. So early on, Superman was fighting, you know, corrupt unions and things like that. He would grab someone's leg and like leap over buildings. He was a bit rougher, and I think he even killed a few people, a bit like Batman in the early days, before they kind of, you know, they kind of cleaned him up, so to speak. But yeah, he was quite rough and ready. And I think Grant Morrison did a recent take on that with the New 52. I think he kind of tried to go back to that those kind of common problems and the corruption and things that we deal with. You know, obviously back in the Depression, there was probably quite a bit of that going on when Superman was created. So that was, you know, it was quite topical at the time, the kind of hero that did that. And obviously being two Jewish boys, they felt they needed a bit more kind of representation or someone they could look up to, someone that other Jewish children could aspire to be, or and his story is very much the story of Moses as well. You know, I'm not going to recite the story of Moses to you because I'm sure you all know. So there's a lot of kind of that kind of Jewish heritage is built into that character. They pretty much signed off before that character became a real hit and took off, they signed the character away to National Comics, which would later be known as DC Comics. That stands for Detective Comics, believe it or not, because that was Batman's first appearance was in Detective Comics. Both Action Comics and Detective Comics are both still running, in fact. So some of the longest running comics of all time. I think I want to say that there was the 1,000th issue of Action Comics came out recently. It was a big kind of bumper edition that came out. So Superman's been around a long time. But yeah, before that character picked up, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster sold the rights to the character because they just didn't think it would be that big a hit. But it was, and it took off like, you know, faster than a speeding bullet. You know, it's just, you know, soared up and away, so to speak. And they couldn't get any money from that character, any royalties because they basically sold off the character, unfortunately, but they did do all the work. And now nowadays it's a bit more accepted that comic book creators have often been screwed out of money and royalties and opportunities work because they've sold the rights to they made that character for a company. You know, Roy Thomas, a very famous Marvel writer, would often he knew this. So what he would do was he would take an old name of a character and rehash them. So for example, like the Black Knight or the Vision during his Avengers run, he would take a character's name and do a new spin on it, much like DC did with the Flash and the Green Lantern back in the 50s. That's what he was doing in kind of mid to late 60s. So that way he didn't have to pay, you know, he wasn't giving away good ideas and giving away good characters. He could keep some of his, you know, more original ideas for himself, so he could do some creator-owned work, which most comic book creators now do, is pretty much all creator-owned work because they need to earn the money. Even Bill Finger, who famously created more of Batman than Bob Kane, really, you know, came with things like Jerry Robinson as well, created a lot of the Batman Rogues Gallery, including the Joker. I think Bill Finger came up with the outfit, maybe even the Batcave, things like that. There's a lot of elements, the classic elements of Batman Bill Finger did. And only recently, only now, in the last year or so, has he been credited with those, with creating those things. So it used to be Batman created by Bob Kane. Now it's Batman created by Bob Kane with Bill Finger. So it's really nice to see that he gets that credit. But again, gone on a tangent there. They call me Tangent Dan, clearly. But when the Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster found out that they were making a, you know, $1 million franchise movie about Superman, they weren't best pleased, to say the least. They both lived most of their life relative poverty, and they also both had failing health. I think by this point, Joe Shuster had lost his eyesight or was in the process of losing it, unfortunately. And basically, Jerry Siegel wrote a press release cursing the film, the upcoming production of the film, and National Comics, as it was known at the time, for this move. So I'm actually going to read the beginning statements of the press release. It's very long-winded and lots of kind of details about it. I've got a link online somewhere. I will share it. You can read the whole story yourself. It's got various letters in it. I found a link. I can't remember the link off the top of my head or who wrote it, but it's got all the information you could require to learn about this. I mean, I couldn't look so much that I couldn't even get through all myself in the time I had. But I'm just going to read the opening statement that Jerry Siegel made. So, it has been announced in show business trade papers that a multi-million-dollar production based on the Superman comic strip is about to be produced. It has been stated that millions of dollars were paid to the owners of Superman, National Periodical Publications, Inc., for the right to use the famous comic book superhero in the new movie. The script is by Mario Puzo, who wrote The Godfather and Earthquake, and the film is to have a star-filled cast. I, Jerry Siegel, the co-originator of Superman, put a curse on the Superman movie. I hope it super bombs. I hope loyal Superman fans stay away from it in droves. I hope the whole world, becoming aware of the stench that surrounds Superman, will avoid the movie like a plague. Why am I putting this curse on a movie based on my own creation of Superman? Because cartoonist Joe Shuster and I, who co-originated Superman together, will not get 1 cent from the Superman super movie deal. Superman has been a huge moneymaker for 37 years. During most of those years, Joe Shuster and I, who originated the character, got nothing from our creation. And through many of those years, we have known want. While Superman's publishers became millionaires, sorry, my Twitter's going up. I'm blowing up. Honestly, every time I do a podcast, blows up. Where was I? So, we have known want. While Superman's publishers became millionaires, read the following and you will get some idea of how it feels to create one of the most successful fictional characters of all time and be cheated out of your share of the profits. the publisher of Superman comic books, National Periodical Publications, Inc., killed my days, murdered my happiness, choked my nights, strangled my career. I consider National executives economic murderers, money mad monsters. If they and the executives of Warner Communications, which owns National, had consciences, they would right the wrongs they inflicted on Joe Schuster and me. So the creators of Superman cursed this movie. Whether you believe in curses or not, they did say that, and they did, well, Jerry Siegel did, and they, unfortunately, bad things have happened to cast, people surrounding the film, and many other things. Famously, Christopher Reeves, who played Superman, is famously had a horse riding accident during an equestrian show, equestrian cross country event, and this paralyzed him from the neck down. He then suffered recently. Recently, 2004, a heart failure, which was stemming from the medication he was on, and basically he died, unfortunately. After this happened, he probably embodied Superman more than ever. He never gave up. He became an advocate for stem cell research and various other things. I became a spokesperson for, you know, anybody that had, you know, a disability. He kept on working so hard to do those things and to bring awareness to these issues and to fund things, scientific, you know, discoveries and various other things. He embodied that character. He truly was a great man, a superman for all and everybody. And he was a wonderful film star and terrific actor, and he is very, very well missed, and he is one of the main victims of this Superman curse. Margot Kidder, who played Lois Lane in the films, she is quite famously known for having, I think in the 90s, she had a bit of a nervous breakdown, and she ended up homeless. It says here that she was in a manic state. She threw away her purse because she believed there was a bomb in it and imagined her ex-husband was a CIA chief who was intent on killing her. She spent 4 days wandering from one place in the city to the other. She told people, she recalled how she was taken in by a homeless man named Charlie, who fed her and gave her a place to sleep in a homeless encampment under a freeway overpass. She said that another homeless man had tried to rape her and knocked out some of her teeth. She eventually turned up in someone's backyard in the bushes, telling the homeowner, "I may not look like it, but I am Margot Kidder." She was retrieved by the police, who found her and took her to a mental ward or a mental health center to help with that. She was severely depressed and had various other kind of problems. She was then, after that, she was medicated, and she was kind of she worked her way back to feeling better and worked on her issues for a long time. She became a spokesperson for mental health in performers and in all walks of life. You know, people dealt with, much like Carrie Fisher as well, a wonderful, wonderful person, a fantastic actress. If you haven't seen Black Christmas, I think that's probably my favorite role of hers. She kind of plays the stereotypical kind of bitch in that, this kind of sorority girl, and she's fantastic in the role. And I'm sad to say I've not seen much more of her work. I did watch Halloween 2 the other night. She is in that. I thought it was nice to see her in that film. And she played a psychiatrist, so it's something. Obviously, it was quite good that you could kind of, she was playing that kind of role, because I think she probably treasured that in a way of, you know, looking after people with psychiatric problems. So she probably quite enjoyed that role, I imagine. But sadly, she committed suicide earlier in the year, I believe. Which is, I imagine, is due to her mental state, unfortunately. But again, a great spokesperson, a great person, and somebody who actually, you know, embodied the character
in their life and on film so very well. So it was definitely sad to hear about that. Moving on to Marlon Brando, who played basically played the alien father of Superman, so Jor-El, so his Kryptonian father. Now he was on the decline for a long time. He kind of became a little kind of a lazy actor, or kind of a bit selfish, wouldn't learn lines and various other things. So he was kind of he wasn't a great actor as he used to be, in regards to Jack Nicholson didn't want to work with him. He was very disappointed because he was one of his heroes. I think it was, I want to say, Six Easy Pieces or something like that. I think you can't remember. Was it Missouri Breaks? Might be Missouri Breaks, actually. They worked together on that film, and he was just doing even on Superman, he even was using idiot boards or idiot cards with all his lines on, so he would just read them off that and do his best acting. But he was also the best actor, you know, one of the best, most prolific, iconic actors of all time, you know. But unfortunately, the main thing that's attributed to the Superman curse in regards to Marlon Brando is that his son Christian basically had some severe mental issues himself and shot his half sister's, that's Cheyenne, her boyfriend in 1990. And this led to 10 years in prison. And then Marlon Brando's other daughter committed suicide. It might be the same daughter, actually. So this led to him being more and more reclusive. And then he died about 3 months before Christopher Reeve did. So that's just a horrible, horrible situation for a father to be involved in. And it's just tragic. All of this is really tragic. But those are the kind of main victims in the regards to the original film. I think it was Lee Quigley, that's it. So Lee Quigley played the baby version of Clark Kent, Kal-El Superman, in the movie. So when they open up, you know, the one that's put into the pod and when he arrives on Earth, when the Kents pick him up, that's Lee Quigley there. And he had a lot of issues with substance abuse, which unfortunately he died at the age of 14, which is really, really sad. In regards to that, but that's the main kind of film in regards to the tragedy that's attributed to those various the film, and in regards to Jerry Siegel's statement that the film was cursed. But it does, it's quite expansive, like what we consider, what the Superman curse is considered. Again, you could consider career failure. Ben Affleck, for example, recently he filmed Batman vs Superman, his marriage failed and he's currently in rehab, so you could argue maybe that's part of the curse. But it depends. If you're superstitious, possibly curses do or do not exist, or it's all just happenstance, it's just unlucky, just people have been very unlucky. It's what interests me is it's just coincidentally all these awful things happen. And the first time the curse was mentioned was really properly by Jerry Siegel himself. Now, Jerry Siegel did eventually win over DC, and they eventually would, Joe Shuster and himself would get a pension. I think it was $200,000 a year for the creation of Superman. Routinely until they died. And I believe the families still get some royalties for the characters that were created. So that's something. So that's one of the good things to come out of that public statement that he made. I truly hope that has nothing to do with all this unlucky, this bad luck that's befallen everybody else in regards to the film. There's a few other ones, few of the people that were kind of technically victims of the Superman curse. Richard Pryor starred in Superman 3's Gus Gorman, and he
not long after he finished the film, I think it was discovered that he was suffering from multiple sclerosis, and that was up until he died. He obviously suffered with that for a very long time. But I think a lot of people will attribute that to his drug use and various other things, but not a Superman curse. And, you know, I'd probably say the same thing. I don't believe in the curse personally. But it's interesting just to look at, and the coincidences that surround them, and the horrible, horrible situations that the stars found themselves in for a long time. Apparently even Superman Returns was, because that was slightly based off of the Richard Donner version. It was kind of a sequel to the Richard Donner version. I think it was a sequel to Superman 2, I believe. It's not a great film, I'll be honest. It's not what I enjoy. I don't like seeing Superman as a creepy deadbeat dad. I do like Brandon Routh. I like a few of the other actors in there, but it's just a poor film, a poor showing for Superman. So apparently Bryan Singer stated that the curse affected the DVD team of Superman Returns. So the people producing the DVD, one of them was mugged, one of them fell down the stairs, and various other things kind of happened. He said they absorbed the curse for the rest of the film. And Kate Bosworth, who played Lois Lane in Superman Returns, she wasn't very good. She wasn't the best Lois Lane. She's probably a bit too young, I think, maybe. A bit too, I don't know. Whatever. But she claimed, this is the ridiculous one, she claims that the breakdown of her relationship with Orlando Bloom was due to the Superman curse. I don't think you're a victim, necessarily, in regards to the rest of them. The rest of the people that are supposedly part of the Superman curse, Kate Bosworth. And in regards to the awful things that have happened to them, I think it's kind of a bit flippant that you've said that one relationship didn't work out and you've like, oh, the Superman curse, you know. I don't like that comment. It makes me feel uncomfortable in regards to everything else and all the other people that have suffered. But what do you think? Tell me, let me know on Facebook and Twitter, and you can, you know, we can discuss it further, but I don't believe there is one. I just think it's just a slew of bad coincidences. But I do think it's interesting to look at and to, you know, but if you believe in it, tell me and make your argument known. Maybe there's other people I haven't mentioned that you think have suffered from the Superman curse, you know, people, I don't know, like maybe Dean Cain, Terry Hatcher, you know, all the people in all the different versions, animated versions as well, maybe, you know. Who knows? But yeah, just discuss it.
Quiz all over me.
All right, it's back to the dirtiest part of the podcast, quiz all over me. So I've got a few questions, not as many as last week, but it's fine. Let's see what we've got. So, my friend Andy Knowles, Angry Andy Knowles, he has sent a couple of questions in. So, his first question was, if Marvel remade Blade within the MCU, either as a film or Netflix show, would you like to see Wesley Snipes back or not? If not, who would you cast in the role? I'm a big fan of the original Blade films. First two are great. Third one, not so much. But he's a phenomenal character, and he ushered in the phase of comic book movies that we're still living through now, like the real resurgence of taking comic book movies seriously. You know, a year after, you know, Batman and Robin almost killed it dead. You know, and it's horror, it's serious, it's, you know, it's funny, it's, yeah, it's great, it's just fantastic. And Blade 2 is Guillermo del Toro doing his greatest, some of his greatest work, in my opinion. He's a great, and I'm kind of a cult movie fan, you know, so I quite like, he's, Wesley Snipes is great in Demolition Man, if you've never seen that. I highly recommend that. Passenger 57, great as well. I think he's a quality actor, and no matter what you think of his, you know, tax dealings or what have you, he's a great performer, and I do love him as Blade. So I would like to see him back, yes. If he wasn't back, who would I have as Blade? Daniel Kaluuya? Kaluuya? Let's say Kaluuya. He's a phenomenal actor. I like him. He's great. younger Blade might be more interesting. But yeah, let's go with him. Andy also asks another question, which is, what is your opinion on the cancellation of Iron Fist and Luke Cage, especially seeing as Daredevil Season 3 has become a huge hit? So I thought Iron Fist Season 2 was... A lot of people thought it was better, but I actually thought it was worse than Season 1. It was just bland, just really bland. It was like, oh, there's a gang war. Oh, it's really interesting. And just everything about it just screamed blandness and spoilers. Danny's just not been treated very well. I don't think he's been written very well. I think that I even wrote an article for Nerdify on how to fix Iron Fist, and obviously they didn't read it because they didn't take anything on board, but why would they? But yeah, it was really poor and just uninteresting. Usually I will do Netflix shows in a week or so, maybe 2 weeks. This took me about a month to finish. It was that hard. And it was 2 episodes less than usual. And it still took me that much time to finish it because it was just boring. Boring, boring, boring. I did like Typhoid Mary. I like the idea of introducing Typhoid Mary. I thought she was really good. But everything else was just dire. Luke Cage, I really liked Season 2. I thought it was really interesting. I liked the whole Yardies, the Jamaican kind of storyline. Thought it was really cool, and I like the end. I like how it ends. Really interesting. I was hoping that they'd go interested to see where they'd go with that, but we're not getting it. I hope that they are. I hope that maybe they're going over to the Disney Plus streaming app, or that maybe we'll be getting a combined show of Iron Fist and Luke Cage, because that's what I really want. Because I think the two actors really bounce off each other, and the characters have a great relationship as well. So I want to see more. I want to see more of that. And yeah, so maybe that's on Disney Plus as well. That could happen. It's a possibility. And Daredevil Season 3, just the best. Just absolutely knocked everything out of the park with that show. You know, it's the closest I'm going to get to Daredevil Born Again, which is one of my top 5 comics of all time, probably. Just so good. They had a lot of the elements that were not included necessarily in Born Again, but they've taken, you know, they introduced Bullseye in a great way. Glad Vincent D'Onofrio came back. Maggie was a great addition. Maggie Murdoch, and yeah, just amazing show. But hopefully we'll see those characters again. They did say they would return the characters in some form, so I certainly hope so. Okay, next question. So this is from Dan Keatis, or at DL Keatis on Twitter. So what did you think of Daredevil Season 3, and where does it rank in terms of... I've kind of already answered that, haven't I, Dan? Yeah, just so good. Brilliant. Brilliant characters, brilliant storylines. You know, the fight scenes are just incredible. Like, it takes me back to... Like, I liked Season 2, to be honest. Like, it wasn't a terrible, terrible season. Like, the first half's really good. Yeah, and I think Hander are good villains. I think they were treated well. And I think I said on the podcast, like, how entertaining it all was. But yeah, it's, you know, it's just too good. It's just too good for words, you know, and that's why I'm struggling to relate that into words. But yeah, it took the best elements of Daredevil and my favorite characters and spun me a new yarn on the existing. I really liked, I think We Have a Hulk did an interview with, oh God, what's his name? Oh, the cop. I'm drawing a blank. Someone's shouting at me. I'm sure We Have a Hulk shouting at me. Because they interviewed the guy who played him. And he was a great addition, like totally, from what I know, a totally original character. But I really liked his arc and storyline. I think it was great. I can't remember his name. But he was a really good character as well. But yeah, it's all good. It's all good. Okay, right. So moving on to... So Jack and the Geeks Talk, or at Jack Geeks Talk. What is your least favorite Spider-Man comic outfit? Oh, this is a thinker. What's my least favorite one? I think it would be Spider-Man 2211, which is we're talking about Spider-Man 2099 earlier. But yeah, he was introduced in that Spider-Man meets Spider-Man 2099, I believe, in that comic. And it's kind of a blue, red, white outfit. And he has like these mechanical arms, red mechanical arms, a big red mechanical kind of helmet visor thing. But to me, it looks a bit like a lobster. It doesn't really look like a spider. It looks more like a lobster. It's a very odd design. I don't know what 2211 is like. I think it's 2211. He just looks weird and red and bizarre. I don't know. I think he's part of some sort of time police or something. Maybe the Time Variance Authority. I think that's the Marvel version of the Time Police. He just looks weird. Just looks a bit too weird. That's the only one that's coming to mind at the moment. Could have just been a Lobster Man. Lobster Man. Yeah, it's not as as appealing a character. I imagine that was one of Stan Lee's ideas, Lobster Man. I think it's Spider-Man 2211, I believe. Something like that. Okay, moving on to the next question. So that's from the Geeky Nerd, or at one Geeky Nerd on Twitter. So trailers. Welcome because they add to the hype, or avoided because of the spoilers. Okay, so back in the day, I think trailers were better when they were older because they were a bit more teasy. Like they would have a catchy title or something like that, and they wouldn't really tell you. They draw you in, those kind of trailers, the ones that aren't as explicit or don't show you as much. And we'd only had access to them at the cinema. We wouldn't have them, when we didn't have TV, we didn't have the internet, we didn't have access to those trailers. We can't, watch them over and over again and decipher them and pick things out and, minute by minute, frame by frame, we decipher them, which is a lot of fun for a lot of podcasts, and various people find that fun to kind of spot things and try and work out. Like I do the same thing with like behind the scenes photos as well and information. But those trailers back in the day were better, in my opinion. I'm a big fan of old trailers. That's why I include certain older trailers in this podcast as well, because I think they're kind of cool. There's something about them that I quite like, the kind of kitschiness of them. But the more modern trailers have been more spoilerific. I mean, look at some of the Sony Spider-Man trailers. They're ridiculously spoilerific. I know Josh from Nerdify, he had a big problem because he was just like, all the trailers just spoil the whole movie. I think that's true of some trailers. But if you look at the Star Wars one, when Force Awakens came out and when Last Jedi came out, those trailers are really good because they draw you in. They really draw you in and get you excited, and they play the theme, all the themes and everything. They really do excite me and get me drawn in without telling me anything. So for me, those are the best modern trailers. Those Star Wars Episode 7, Episode 9, 10, whatever episode we're on. Those Force Awakens, Last Jedi, those trailers are what trailers should be now. They just draw you. We like Spider-Man characters. We know what he's going to do. We know his thing. We know what he's about. We don't see every battle or every sequence that he's in. I think the MCU, the Spider-Man Homecoming trailers were good as well. They weren't too spoilerific. There's some good twists in the Spider-Man movie. But yeah, so I'm kind of undecided a little bit. I don't know how to answer that, really. I think there's good and bad things about both. I think... I try and actually avoid spoilers. I know Andy Knowles, who asked the question earlier, he would go to a cinema and put headphones on to avoid trailers spoiling things, which I think, again, it's a bit extreme. but I understand it. I get it, because you want to be surprised by a film. You want to be drawn in, and you want those twists to come unexpectedly. You want to experience it. A lot of people had an issue with Last Jedi, but I loved it. I had a great time. It felt like a Star Wars movie. A lot of people told me that I'm wrong, because that's what the internet's about. And people have opinions, and they want to tell you that yours is wrong. But I love that film. I thought it was great. I thought it was one of the films I've been to, more so than Infinity War. Star Wars The Last Jedi felt like a cinematic event for me. So and maybe that was because I wasn't... Those trailers didn't spoil all that for me. I think it depends how trailers are made. It depends who is making the trailer. The people who make the trailers get a ton of footage, and they have to cut that together in a certain way to make it seem like a narrative, to seem interesting.
and to do it. The directors aren't really involved, I don't think, or I'm not sure if they have a say-so necessarily. Maybe they do more nowadays because that's more important. But yeah, I can't really say either way. I'm not going to answer the question, basically, because I can't. I don't know what to say either way. But there's good and bad things. There's good and bad things. And I think I'm going to leave that unanswered because that's just the way I roll. I can't. There's too many variables in that question for me to fully say yes or no on either. But thank you very much, Geeky Nerd, for your question. So we have a Hulk. We have a Hulk pod on Twitter. They would say, would you like to see Deadpool, Spider-Man crossover with Tom Holland and Ryan Reynolds? Or would it work or would it dilute Deadpool's humor? Now, they've recently announced that they are making a PG-rated Deadpool 2. So they're going to cut that into a film where it's going to be like Princess Bride. They've got Fred Savage and Deadpool. In Princess Bride, he's being read his story by his grandfather. I think it's played by Columbo, Peter Falk. And in this, they're obviously doing an homage to it. And I think there's quite a lot to be said for Deadpool trying not to swear. And yeah, there's a great episode of The Ultimate Spider-Man, not my favorite cartoon show, but Deadpool is in it. And he's like, I'm going to unalive them. And he's like, you're going to kill them? And he's like, no, I can't say kill. Unalive. You have to say unalive because of the censors. And so I think there's a lot of humor to be had there by him trying to be PG, but not being PG. He's trying not to be violent. So he's trying to do things the good way. And Spider-Man constantly has to say, don't kill them. Don't do that. You know, kind of, I think there's a bit of fun to be had there. You know, things can be done off screen. There's clever ways of doing humor and violence. You know, there's ways of editing and doing a certain joke without it, you know, offending the censors. So I think there's fun to be had there with a character like Deadpool. Yes, would I like a more slightly adult one as well? Yeah, I'd take that. But then again, you'd have the issue with Spider-Man as well. Is Spider-Man, do we want to see Spider-Man in an R-rated movie? Do we want to see, I love the darker Spider-Man stories like Kraven's Last Hunt, you know, like Back in Black and things like that. I really like those stories. I like when we get an angry, darker, more depressed Spider-Man because it's such a change, such a dramatic change. You know, Spider-Man is being serious when he stops telling jokes, you know, he's in serious, dire straits. But I don't know if the cinema going audience would respond to that. They might be like, ooh, you're being like DC, trying to be like DC, edgy and dark and cool, you know, but I think I prefer the PG one where Deadpool is restricted and it has to, and is making jokes and the comedy comes from him being restrictive in regards to violence and language and what he can say and what he can't say. And there could be jokes about Spider-Man being 15 years old as well, things like that, 16 years old. I think there's a lot of humor to be played with in a PG rated movie. So I would go with that one over the R-rated version. But and I think Ryan Reynolds is again, he's doing a PG version of Deadpool, but obviously he's going to be, you know, there's probably not a lot of footage that he can show. So I'm quite looking forward. I hope they get some release over in the UK, the Deadpool Christmas Tale or whatever, or Merry Christmas Deadpool, or whatever it's called. I can't remember the title, but if that does come over here, I will go and watch it. And that is the final question. So we've come to the end of this week's podcast. So I'm just going to let you know where you can find us now, or find myself. Again, just me and the elf with a gun at the window forcing me to make this podcast. So we're on Facebook. So if you search on Facebook and go at Secret Bores, Twitter, we are at Dan_Bores. And this podcast is available on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thank you again for everybody who has downloaded. I think we're up to 36, 35 downloads. We've got people downloading in Sweden, the States, Canada, and loads in the UK. So much, much love and appreciation to everyone who has listened. And I hope you enjoy this one as much as you enjoyed the last one. All right, guys. And remember, if you're going to tweet or talk about us, remember to hashtag join the Pratalion or hashtag prepare for prattle.
All right, signing off, guys. See you next week.